Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, and part two of My Racing Life with Kevin Jeanette. I'm hoping you are coming in just after listening to part one and getting plenty of silly, crazy, amazing stories from Kev. And we stopped right when he was starting to explain how things went down so famously at the 1985 Rolex 24 at Daytona between Supertech's A.J. Foyt and brilliant Bob Wallach. We're going to dive straight into that. If you need a little bit more of an intro into Kevin's life and career, if you're coming in straight into part two, I would strongly suggest going back to part one and listening to that first. This episode, part two, which closes this part off at least, is really very heavily featuring his IMSA career and lots more of the insanity that he took part in. And also a little bit more stuff in recent years as we head to Rennsport Reunion this year, where I believe Kevin's bringing something like 17 cars. Just an animal. Absolute animal. You know you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes, on Podbean, and on a variety of content aggregators. You can also go to our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page, like that, do something with it, and get every single episode the moment that they go live. All right, off we go with Kevin Jeanette, part two of My Life and Racing Career.
During the race, Wallach was just so pissed off, he just left. He hung out for a little bit. I put this car in the lead. I'm the fastest. I put this car in the lead. This is impossible. Now you put A.J. Foyt in the car. He crashes the car. Why do I even do this? You name it, he said it. In whatever best English he could come up with, because he's very French, very German French, very Swiss French. You know the border, right, where he's from.
Yep.
So Prussen, you can't even reach Cloud 9 with a helium blimp because he's past Cloud 9 up. With the whole A.J. Foyt thing. Oh, my God. Everybody is, and it says the swap shop on the car. It's the single best moment for anybody that was in that pit box for 24 hours. Got to be a part of that.
Wow.
To me, still the second most thing, and I give my kids credit for having children with my wife, who is in question with me being born and my parents for second. But the whole A.J. Foyt thing and Wallach and being there with them and then winning the race and being on the pole, I think it's only ever happened once or something that a car won from the pole. So with all that in mind, during the race, ships in the night.
Hmm.
There was a point when it rained, and then they got to talk. And they, because A.J. produced, A.J. went out, and in the rain was the magic man. There is nothing Wallach could say, because all you had to do is look at the timesheet and go, wow, this guy's fast, because he was. A.J. in that car was the old A.J., because he was, you know, getting up there. He was in his 40s for sure, high 40s, you know, if you go back in time, when he drove the car for us. You couldn't, to have the two of them in, and they didn't need Ballow anymore. They didn't need Preston for sure. They didn't need anybody because the two of them were connected as race car drivers, and they then start chatting it up. By the time we got to the victory circle, you never saw two guys become best friends quicker.
Wow.
Than them. Because they both appreciated. I mean, more so, everybody knew who A.J. Foyt was. When he says, so who is A.J. Foyt? Of course, Wallach knew who he was. And I guarantee you that A.J. only knew who Wallach was because everybody said, you get to drive with Wallach? Then it, you know, a monkey could figure out that Wallach was as good as he was by people saying, you're with Wallach, really? Oh, my God, to have him as the guy you're going to drive with? Sheesh. So with all that going on, you know, it was a relationship that would last a lifetime. I have photos from when we raced at the Palm Beach Grand Prix, and they were on different teams at that point. Wallach was driving for Bayside, and A.J. was driving R962 with Danny and Gaius. and that one of my guys was a professional photographer. He took a picture of the two of them, like, clinging onto each other, head to head, like they were boyfriend and girlfriend, like the most impressionable "we are best pals" photo ever taken of two race car drivers ever. And we have that picture. Sure, is that on our website? She's not in here. Anyway, yeah, so it became that. And then, of course, in 85, I left the team for personal reasons between Preston and I. So I ordered the 962, which was then the Valvoline car that won it. Mike Colucci took the team over, and they won then the very first race for a 962 with 962-104, and then they went on to win Sebring. And I came back into the picture at the end of 85 for 86, and then had, keep in mind, when they won Daytona, when Preston of the Swamp Shop car won Daytona in 85, it was Terry Bootson, Unser,
yep,
Al Unser. Yeah, I mean, these are, you know, start adding up, and Foyt, start adding up now Indy wins. When we then took the car back and went to Daytona in 86, I had Sullivan, Foyt, and Leyendijk in the car.
I know. It's pretty ridiculous.
So people say, well, so you went with the car in 85. No, I was actually there in 85 with the first Camel Lights prototype, and we won there with it. So I still got to win, so I never look at it as I didn't get to win in 85, and I've been with Preston ever since. So it wasn't even a hiccup for me. I mean, Mike did a stellar job. And Porsche built a stellar car because they picked the car up and out of the box it won the 24 Hours of Daytona. Are you kidding? You know, they put an engine in it and then it won the 12 Hours of Sebring. So, you know, how cool is that? But then you start adding up the guys that, you know, drove these cars for Preston, just these few races that he would do, because he only really needed the PR, which is what he was spending all the money for the swap shop, which, by the way, is the second most attended any kind of a recreational or people visited anything in Florida second to Disneyland. So, you know, we talk about the swap shop flea market or anything that Preston has done for all you racers out there listening. You know, go to his website and you'll see what kind of a car guy he has, because he's got, like, everything and current. But, you know, so with all that in mind, blending those two guys together and watching them through their lifetime and then being there when Wallach was killed at Sebring riding his bike, you know how sometimes trivial certain things are in your lifetime, but then how lucky you were. The Swap Shop 935, I was the crew chief at Riverside for Mario Andretti, Michael Andretti, A.J. Foyt, and Bill Whittington. Mario, Michael, A.J., and Bill Whittington. And Preston, two 935s. Could you imagine A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti? Now, you know, the two of them, they'd each call each other names, which I won't repeat, all in good fun, but it didn't sound like it then. But it's like they're both godfathers to everybody's kid. John Andretti's godfather is A.J. Foyt. Michael's godfather is A.J. Foyt. So, you know, you think of all the transition between, you know, all these IndyCar guys that are the best drivers in the world, you know.
Came through Preston. I know.
Came through Preston, yeah.
It's one of the great parts of the 80s sports cars.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. Exactly. And again, I'm sorry for all you guys to have to listen to me rambling on about this. And
this is why we're talking. This isn't rambling. This is storytelling with Uncle Kevin.
Yeah. So you know, you think of what then goes down in one's career. And I'm in my 20s. And I'm the engine builder, too. So for me, I always say, and I can say this on radio or TV, I've always seemed to have bigger balls than brains, you know? And I've had coaching by guys like Preston Henn, who is a bull in a china shop most of the time, but he walks out and there isn't a broken china piece at all. When he comes out, you hear everything banging around, and he walks out, and there's nothing broken. He's that good with his ideas, and sometimes, you know, to a point where you don't want to deal with it. So, okay, can we just get back to racing, Kevin? Maybe you're forgetting why we're doing this. And I have to remember, yeah, who's paying the bills? The swap shop, you know. That, oh my gosh, you know, some of the great memories that stem from that. And then at that point, you know, I've just went on back to the whole Florida scene. More guys would call. Bob Snodgrass from Brumos was getting a 962, and we knew that we were crew chiefing Preston's last 962, and Preston actually pulled the plug. I said, Preston, you know, we're prepping a new, we bought a brand new car, so we had two cars. We bought a brand new car, which ended up being the Primus 962 that I got to be Brian Redmond's crew chief.
Well, you're cracking the door open on my next question about Primus. I mean, that wasn't a team that I think many folks would have cause to remember simply because it didn't last as long as it should have, but... good Lord, that to me seemed like a true kind of merry band of folks trying to do big things. I know that, you know, between Neifel had heard that, you know, there might have been some invoices that could still be paid on that program 30 plus years ago. But tell me about that, because, you know, we can, well, and hopefully we will talk some more about some of the big things that you've done in terms of high profile, big name, Foyt, Andretti, etc. I just loved this program, and having seen it a little bit, having seen you guys at a couple of races in whatever it was, 87, I believe.
87,
Tell me about this. This was kind of a merry band of good people trying to do big things with not a ton of resources with the 962, yet you got this big 9'7", you know, Sasquatch-looking guy in Neifel. You've got everyone's favorite, you know, tea time partner in the lovely... Brian Redmond. There was an odd couple element to it. I don't know, brother. This just sounds hard to be true.
It was too good to be true for more reasons than one, because Neifel's backing was his stepfather, who was the big Chicago insurance magnate. His name doesn't come to me now, but he's like an E.F. Hutton, you know, kind of a guy from his day with insurance, you know. And tons of money, but he had then passed away, and the mother, Chris's mom, you know, then controlled the dough, and she was married to this guy who was with a hospital association called American Medical, AMI, and somehow all the money was there, and then a divorce happened, and all the money disappeared, and Brian and I were left holding the bag. But everything before that was this car that I had bought for Preston, this new car, which is 962-123, which is actually owned today by a gentleman named Jeffrey Sprecher, who is the guy that owns this other company called ICE. And ICE owns New York Stock Exchange. Yeah. So that car, and it was, and I sold the car to Vern Schuppen. And it became a Rothman's car. So, you know, that car has its own little, you know, batch of coolness for sure, which overshadows the fact that me and Redmond are still owed money, not from Chris Neifel, but from the organization. And, you know, we don't blame Chris for anything because we had a good time. But sometimes that's all you got is we had a good time. But anyway, I'd rather have a good time and not make money than make a lot of money and not have a good time.
Sure.
No, I'd rather make the money and not have a good time. But anyway, so Preston's, I say, Preston, we need to get a new car. This car's long in the tooth. You know, this new technology with the front suspension has a different geometry change now. And I said, but we have enough stuff. All we need is the front of the car. We need everything from the cockpit forward, from the firewall forward, fuel cell, gauges, front nose, steering, suspension, doors, everything. I have the whole back. I have a tail, I have an under tray, I have an engine and gearbox, all the rear suspension, blah, blah, blah. That has not changed. So I order this new car. That way, it comes a tub complete, doors and all. Before we get it, Preston calls me up and says, how much is it going to cost to put that car together? What's our budget for Daytona? And I gave him a number, and he says, I'll call you back. First time he ever said that. You're going to call me back? First flag for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is he going to call me back?
You knew something was up.
Yeah, something's up. I already ordered the car, already sent the deposit. Hello. He calls me back, and he says, I don't think we've ever spent that much money at Daytona before. And I said, everything's becoming more expensive, and we've never actually bought a new car for Daytona. The other new car that we bought, I never got. Colucci got it. So that wasn't me. Now, otherwise, if it wouldn't have been my car, I would have said, well, you were into this one a lot less than you're into buying 104. But I didn't know that. I didn't think of that, so I didn't say that. All I could say was, maybe it's time we don't do this anymore. He said, excuse me? I said, I don't ever remember you asking me about how much it was going to cost. He says, to his partner, he had a partner that he took on, his wife's twin sister, Betty's twin sister, Nettie, her husband was one of the swap shop guys and partner in business, and he looked at him and he said, Kevin's suggesting that we don't go to Daytona, that we pull the plug. I never said pull the plug. I just said we ought to not do this event anymore.
Yeah.
Don't bug me with what is it going to cost. What do they say? If you can't afford it, don't do it, right? I didn't say that because he would have punched me out.
Mm.
Anyway, because I would have been, you know, sassing him, and I don't do that to adults. So his partner says, best thing I ever heard Kevin say.
Wow.
I can hear him yelling on the phone. Preston says, I'll call you back again. He called me back about 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Who knows when he called me back, but it was right back. And he said, pull the plug. And I said, really?
Oh, man.
Sell the car. And I said, uh-oh. So I called Peter Schmitz up, who was the Porsche parts rep guy. He said, you got to talk to Mrs. Bear, or as we called her at Porsche, Frau Bear, in the fatherland, in Stuttgart. It wasn't Weissach then. And I said, is that car we bought, do we have to take that? She goes, why, what happened? And she was married to an American serviceman, even though her last name was Bear, like Bear Coolers,
mm-hmm.
who is a German-American. And he stayed after the war, and they got married, so she was Mrs. Bear by that. Marrying an American, crazy. So her English was really, really good. And I said, Mrs. Bear, I said, Preston's pulling the plug. Oh, but he's done so good lately. And I said, I know, but, you know, there's change. I said, what do I do? I need to tell him something. Can we get our money back? Should we sell it again? What do we need to do? She goes, that's not even a whole car. And I says, I know. I ordered it from you. I know. She says, I'll call you back. She calls Holbert. Holbert's becoming Porsche North America. Hey, you want this car? I'll take it. 962s were really hot. He takes the car. We're happy. All's good. And puts it together. Because it's still half a car that's already coming to him. Because he's Porsche North America now. Everything went to Pennsylvania. Reading, Pennsylvania. He gets the car. Finishes up, puts a motor and transmission, puts a new tail on. Bingo, we got a done car. Redmond calls me up. Hey, man, can you run a team for us? I heard that the swap shop is quitting. And I said, yeah, but in the meantime, Bob Snodgrass called me and asked if I'd run his new Copenhagen car for A.J. Foyt. I'm really thinking I'm somebody, and I'm still just a grease monkey working on old Porsche vintage cars at this point and racing part-time. I'm thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. He says, you told Snodgrass that you couldn't do it because you were going to put the new car together. I think Snodgrass has already found somebody. I go, oh, that was quick. He says, by the way, I'm buying the new car.
Wow.
I go, that was quick. This all took place in like 2 days, it seemed. It might have been a week, you know. I'm going, wow, you're kidding. Foyt's now got a Copenhagen car. He's going to drive with Hurley with Snodgrass, a fab car, tubbed car. Preston's quit. Redmond's going racing. And I get to be on Redmond's team. I am not anybody but the guy that's going to do the team. I'm not the chief guy. A guy named Don Sneeders is. They get Don Sneeders because Chris Neifel is friends with Sneeders. His nickname, he does, they just call him Sneeders. Sneeders worked for IMSA for years after this took place as a technical guy. Sneeders comes from Atlantic and Open Wheel stuff. So Sneeders, Redmond has Sneeders call me. Hey, man, Don Sneeders, just call me Sneeders. Since we always say, we got this deal. We need a shop and a guy that knows 962s. I'm going to be the team manager, blah, 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 blah. I said, wow, okay. So before you know it, they buy the car. It ends up with Forsyth because they're all in that Chicago area. Isn't that where Forsyth was?
Yeah.
Somewhere near Chicago. And they got a lead mechanic, John, who's still racing stuff today, but he does a lot of Formula Ford. John Betos. Yeah, yeah. Betos does, he's a Van Diemen distributor, I think. And something else now, but a good guy, but also nobody that knew anything about 962s was just Gunner Racing. So the team is going to be based there, and I got to go back and forth, and that ain't going to work. So I said, I'll help you as best I could. The car's already whole. You got to do that. And I flew in and told them what to do, blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, the car came here before it went to Daytona, and we could all get acclimated to it, get all the gear ready. And then they had their own trailer that they bought from. It was the Domino's pizza rig for Little Al.
Yeah, the Shearson one.
Yeah, which I ended up buying. And Preston owns it now, and it's parked in front of the swap shop with a big swap shop banner on it. He bought it just so he could have a rolling banner. So his trailer's got history. Oh, if that trailer could talk. Anyway, about, I don't know, Sneeders made it to Daytona or just before Daytona. He didn't like the fact that everything was about Gunner Racing. And he got let go. Not by me. I don't know by who, but he got let go. Then the car left there and came right from Daytona. It went back to Daytona there because at Daytona they had a bad batch of wrist pins and the wrist pin broke. And Porsche warranted the broken part, but then, you know, someone had to do the motor. I did one of the motors and Andal did one of the motors because we had two. Because we had to take the other motor apart because it had the same faulty wrist pin in it. And then we went to see, anyway, so we DNF, but that was with Brian, Elliot Forbes Robinson, and Chris. And we nicknamed the car Knothead because Chris was so tall I had to put the famous GT40 or 512 bubble on the roof because Chris's head was so tall. The bubble extended the roll bar by almost 3 inches. So talk about what safety was in those days. So we nicknamed it Knothead or Knucklehead or something we called the car because of this. You know, it was an aero bump, but Chris's head was above the roll bar, and his eyes barely saw underneath the roll bar that went at the windshield. It was crazy how he could even drive in the car. So we ended up starting the season. We went then to Sebring, and we got on the podium. We finished third with the three of them. And it was a good race. We were only as good as third. I don't think we were ever destined to finish second, but we did good to finish third. So that was nice. We got a podium, and then we went on the road with it. We went to Riverside. We went to Miami. Then it was the Miami Grand Prix. We did that. I don't know what happened there. I think Chris got hit by somebody or something. It was just Chris and Brian. And then we went to Riverside with Chris and Brian, And that's where I hooked up with Paul Newman. That's mm-hmm. when Paul Newman gets in the fray.
Yep.
Because he's buddies with Neifel because they race in Trans Am together. And they're always gagging each other. Like, Neifel would get a bus and take it to Lime Rock and put 50, 80-year-olds in it and say Paul Newman's, you know.
Fan club.
Exactly. So then they come out. And then Newman would get a boat or an airplane and tow the thing behind it and say something about Chris Neifel and fly around whatever track they're at. Neifel sucks. He's a blah, blah, blah. So him and Neifel did this all the time. So we get to a one-day test before the six-hour at Riverside, and Newman's there driving his Nissan, his little GTO car,
mm-hmm.
and he's there to test the same day. It's a Devendorf car. And they're working on it still, and we're doing a clutch coming from wherever we did. I forget why we were doing. We went out there. We had to leave in a hurry from Riverside or something, and we're working on the car. And Newman comes up on his little bike, and he says, "Hey, you the crew chief of this thing?" And I'm looking around. I'm the only guy there. I go, "I guess." He goes, "Neifel here?" I said, "No. He's not going to be here until tomorrow." He goes, "Oh, so you're not here to test?" And I said, "No." He says, "I'm here to test." He says, "That's a pretty cool car." And Neifel says, it's really great to drive. And I said, "It is." And I said, "How'd you like to drive it?" He says, "Well, Chris said I could drive it." And I said, "Yeah, I'm sure he did." Because of the joking that they always did. I said, "But I'm serious." He goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "How would you like to drive it?" He goes, "Are you kidding me?" Back to the does the bear in the woods thing.
Yeah.
And I said, "Yeah, you can drive the car." And he said, "Neifel really never said I could drive the car." And I said, "I'm the boss of the car. And if I say you can drive it, you can drive it." And I says, "I have meaning here. We're just finishing up putting a clutch in, and you could take it out because we're not going to have to pay for you because you're already paid to drive a car here. So if you take it out for me, we'd be indebted to you." By now, the team's showing up because it was, you know, they were eating lunch or something. And they're all seeing, you know, Paul hanging out. Paul's as cool a guy as there ever was. And we're all just talking about cars because you didn't talk about movies or anything because that was not what you did with him. Nor did you want to, you know, because he's a great driver. Better driver than he was an actor, I always said. So he says, "Well, tell me when you're going down." He still thinks I'm kidding. And I says, "Okay." I says, "I'll drive it down the pit lane and just, you know, come on down." We get done in the next 30 minutes or so. We're ready to go. Beautiful sunny day. There's only about two cars out. It's Wednesday. And I don't think anything really got going until, you know, maybe someone went go on Thursday, which we rented Thursday, and then the whole thing started on Friday.
Yeah.
So I take the car down there, and we're all sitting by the car. There's no one down there but us. We're down there 20 minutes. He had to have seen us.
Yeah.
I drove right by Devendorf's pit. Well, all of a sudden, here comes Newman in a street clothes on the same, you know, that little bike he rode around that folds up into a, and you put it in your front pocket.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. And he comes down the hill into the pit lane. And he goes, "What are you guys doing?" And they all looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, "We're waiting on you." He goes, "You're kidding." He said, "I thought you were kidding." I said, "I told you it was your lucky day. You get to drive one of the best race cars ever made on Earth." He goes, "I'll be right back." He pedals this thing, lowers the gear, pedals this little bike up the hill. Honest to God, he was still zipping his suit up when he came back down the hill. He had his hand, he had a bandage wrapped around his shifting hand, his right hand.
Mm.
And I thought, wonder what that's all about. I mean, you know, ace band-aid and wrapping, you know, the tape, you know, the white tape. And he says, "How's it shift?" And I says, "It's unbelievable." He says, "It looks pretty small." And I says, "It is, but it's got a great fulcrum lever action going on back there. You don't see it. It's just really easy." He says, "Because I hurt a tendon in the palm of my hand," and I think we all kind of said, "Oh yeah, we know how you did that, ha ha ha." So he says, "Oh, I can do it, I can do it." And I says, okay. I get it. I show them everything in the car. So here I am. The last guy I got goosebumps over showing something was A.J. Foyt, how to drive a Volt or how to shift a Volkswagen. And it's the same pattern in the 962, except there's a little trick about, you know, getting into reverse gear. You got to detent it to second gear. And there's a fifth gear or so. So he's in there. He says, simple enough. And I said, look, when the boost comes on, hang on. And I said, I'll screw some boost out, because at this point now, the boost regulation is done outside the car.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't let us do it inside the car anymore. It's outside the car. So I screwed it down to, you know, one bar of boost, which was enough for a new guy for sure. So I said, go out, do one recon lap so we know the clutch is okay. We'll lift the bonnet up, look, and then you can go out and play around. Okay, man, let me go, let me go. Off he goes. Comes in, oh my God, you couldn't wipe it off his face, if you know what I mean.
Wow.
We take the bonnet off, we look, and he is like a pig in shit. And I said, go out for 10 more. And I got him on the clock now, because you know he's going to be quick. And he was quick. So off he goes. I said, come in 4 or 5 laps and we'll talk about it. He comes in, he goes, I can't believe it. I can't believe this car. He said, why am I driving what I'm driving if I could drive a car like this? I said, you could drive a car like this. I said, that's entirely up to you. But it's not as cheap to drive a car like this as it is one of those over there, you know. Yeah, I get it, I get it. So I said, I'm going to turn the boost up now. He goes, what do you mean? I said, I'm going to turn the boost up. I'll give you what we'd run at the 24 Hours of Daytona. He says, you mean I didn't even have all the boost? I said, no. I says, I'm going to give you about another 80 or 100 horsepower. He goes, I don't know if I can handle it. I said, you can handle it. Just ease into it. Just don't go in coming out of 1 or going into 6 or back in the back stretch. Just know what you got going on now. I says, it's noticeable. He goes out and he does 5 or 6 laps. And I mean, he did, I don't know what his times were now, but I remember everyone kept looking at it and we were going, God, that's as fast as, you know, anybody. And he comes in and he goes, I don't know how I'll ever thank you. And I remember, I know how you can thank me, and I'll tell you about it when we get back to the garage. He said, anything. He said, no, and I owe Neifel too. Oh my God. And I said, I'm not so sure you ought to tell Neifel. I said, you'll have this one on him. You can play this back at him. Oh, I better tell him I drove his car. I'm sure glad I didn't hurt it. So we go back to the garage. It was my wife's, I think we were turning 30. It was something. I bought her a new watch. And I said, we just had Gunner. So we were 30. We just had Gunner. He was a little 86, 87. Gunner was born in 83. We just had Jesse.
Okay.
We just had Jesse. Well, Sharon and I were just talking about this because it came up with when I met Paul Newman. Anyway, so we get up there and I said, where are you staying? He goes, is that important? He always said something. I don't know if that's the words he said, but he always, you know, he answered your question with an answer or with a question. And I said, no, there's something I want you to do for me now. And you had to treat him like he was a regular guy. If I treated him like Paul Newman, I would have asked for his autograph and said, look what I just did, Mom, you know.
Sure.
But you didn't treat a guy like him that way. I already had that experience with other guys. So we stayed in the same hotel, and I said, I bought my wife a new watch, and I'd like to for you to give it to her for her birthday. And Sharon has never been starstruck by anybody. And we're from Southern California. We used to go to Hollywood all the time. We used to see actors and actresses here, there, where, whatever, you know. Who cares? But Paul Newman? Ding, 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 ding. I was going to get it all on the good side. He said, that's it? He said, that's easy. Where's the watch? And I says, it's back in the hotel, because this is, it's Saturday night, we're going to do it. He goes, you tell me when and where, and I'll cancel whatever I got to give your wife her birthday present. As it ended up, whatever kid was at her parents' house, which was in Downey, California, which is about a 50-minute drive from Riverside, she couldn't come because the kid was sick. And I said, you got to come. She goes, I can't, man, you know, I don't want to leave it with Grandma and Grandpa, blah, blah, blah. And I, no, you got to come. don't miss this. You know, it's not that big a deal. I could come for the race, you know. No, you got to come tonight. Or, she couldn't come. So to this day, we talk about Paul Newman. It was a kind of a joke because then Paul Newman started driving our Porsches. So then Gunner and Paul Newman were in the Guinness Book of Records as the oldest and the youngest pairing of a race car driver at Daytona. Gunner was on the Today Show. Gunner did a To Tell the Truth episode because of Paul Newman. Gunner, you know, blah, 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 because of milking the Paul Newman thing.
Wow.
Then we built Doc Hudson for Paul Newman for the movie Cars. It was at the movie premiere, blah, blah, blah. I met John Lasseter from Pixar because then we became best friends because of I was the only guy building a car that wasn't built for Pixar. You know,
Yeah. Because
I could build it quick enough, because they didn't build one for Paul Newman, which is something that still bothers me. But Lasseter let us build this Hudson on a Kyle Petty Craftsman Mattel Hot Wheels truck.
Wow.
So the Hudson you see, if you go to our website, you can see the building of it. It's really the Petty Racing Mattel Hot Wheels Craftsman truck that we took the body off and we made a composite Hudson body to look like the Paul Newman character, Doc Hudson, in the movie Cars, which is now coming out again. Hence me just taking the Hudson back to the swap shop with all of his other cars on display there, because the kids love Doc Hudson. Now the kids that saw that movie are all, you know, yuppie young college kids now, which is kind of weird. And they're coming out with another Cars 3. I'll be the first to promote it to those of you on the podcast who are listening. Cars 3 comes out, I think, June 17th and 17th, and I am told through the internet that Lightning McQueen and the character Doc Hudson come back one way or the other.
Nice.
How they're going to do Doc Hudson, it's still, I think Lasseter is quoted saying, we don't quite know what we're going to do or how we're going to do it, but the legacy of Lightning McQueen is based on the mentorship of Doc Hudson.
Wow.
So anyway, so full circle once again. Paul's not with us anymore. Talk about one of the greatest guys anybody could ever meet.
Absolutely.
And everything in between.
Well, let's... I have a couple other notes here that I'd love to delve into. I don't know which one... tell me which one you would prefer. The 966, that to me is a car that I have tons of photos of and I have a lot of passion for. And I'm also fascinated by the Miami Vice mid-80s era of sports car and Indy car, which you were, granted, you were just more on the straight team side, but the whole Whittington Lanier time as well, both in sports cars and Indy cars, the Pauls as well. That to me is a great time that needs to have a book written about it. And, you know, enough time has gone on. Jail time's been served. Like, you know, folks are upstanding members of society now. So to me, it might have been it might have been, you know, hush hush ish back in the day. But what was it? Well, I was going to say, what was it like being a part of something that in time has almost, you know, become mythological in the sense that, those cars don't have any sponsors on them or any real sponsors. Huh, that's weird.
We had Sun System with the Whittingtons.
Sure, okay.
We had a suntan lotion on there. Come on.
Sure.
That had to pay big dividends for the Whittingtons.
What was that time
those
like
days
for you, brother?
We're pioneering.
Yeah, it was a very original form of paying for motor racing. You obviously are someone who, you know, you're tasked with making a team happen, making the Whittington succeed. There's also Indy 500 in there as well. Tell me about that intersection. You'd mentioned, you know, obviously through Preston, there was kind of a lot of good, interesting people that you're meeting and working with and running and whatnot. But where did the Whittingtons come into your professional career, and how did you manage trying to do your job while not letting their job get, you know, there be any overlap there?
In the early days, it was easy because, as I mentioned earlier, that the the fact that I could build the engines and do the composite work and be a team player for whatever, paid for these guys, because it was always a problem finding what we nicknamed a body buddy, someone who could come and, repair something, or, most of the guys on the team could figure out how to use fiberglass or epoxy, but didn't have any talent past mixing it. So I brought that to the plate, so to speak, when I said, I'm not doing anything at the next race. Do you need anybody? Yeah, sign up. Because at that point, in the early days, I was, I had sold my Porsche shop and was living in Fallbrook, California, which is inland from Oceanside in San Diego County. So live kind of near the beach, but kind of in the sticks too, just to kind of, not race all the time, and I wasn't working on streetcars all the time. I was starting to race more from that area, and Sharon was going to college to become a nurse. So, it was easy to then state what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, because I didn't have to join the team because I couldn't. So I would just fly in. So I met the Whittingtons through one of the mechanics, Jim Weber, who was on the Whittington team when it began, and wherever they got Weber from, I think. He was friends with Glenn Blakely, and I don't know, it's word of mouth, you can start gathering people. And he came into the program, and then I actually met him when I was doing Cliff O'Kearns, and then Marty Hines, who bought Cliff O'Kearns' car, and made it into a 935. So he had met me doing the whole Cliff O and Marty thing, and then he needed somebody, and because we were then friends, because you always, you park next to each other in the garages or this or that, and we were all connected through mutual friends from the Palm Beach area, and Weber was actually from the other coast. He's from Sarasota, so it was not that big a deal for him to come over and become a Whittington. So he had called and asked if I could help the Whittingtons out. So I said, yeah, okay. So I came, and the first race for them was right after they won Le Mans with the K3 with Kramer, and I joined the team right then, and then helped them run three cars at Mid-Ohio, the Lumberman's 500, which Bobby Rahal ended up winning, co-driving with Brian Redman in a little Ralt. It was a combination of these little sports cars and us big 935 guys.
Yeah.
And they kind of cleaned our clock, but I think Peter Gregg finished second or third, and we were behind them. And I think it was Rahal and Redman, I think, won in this little and Mr. Red Roof Inn himself, little Ralt.
Yeah.
So that was the connection there, and then I would fly in for races for a week, and not them all, because I had other stuff that I was doing. And then at that point I met Preston. We were at Daytona in 81 with Marty Hines. 80 or 81 with Marty Hines and Gary Belcher, who also had a 934 from the Miami area, and I don't know if we had three drivers or not. And Marty let his best buddy's kid sit in the car to play race car. Kid was 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. And the kid saw that big old knob on the dashboard, and everybody knows that was what we call the money knob, the boost knob. And the kid knew what it was, too. And so he's in there, and he starts playing with it. Of course, it's, none of them. They don't have clicks in them. You don't know where it is. You just turn it because of where it was. There's a red mark on it, so you could kind of know when you started the race the red mark was up, and you turn it. It's a linear knob, So the kid gets in there, and he's messing with it, and then it's loose. It needs to be tight. So he tightens the knob up, which means it's maximum boost. Nobody knew it. And when you're idling around, it's not making maximum boost because it needs wind to make boost.
Yep.
So we take it to the starting grid, and Marty starts out. So this thing's got 1,000 horsepower.
Yeah, this is Sebring 82 or so?
This is still Daytona.
Oh, Daytona.
The Daytona finale. Always at the finale, the exciting stuff. So, and I'm not with my wife because that's my anniversary weekend. So he takes off. By the time he gets out of the carousel, he says, "Man, this thing's really running good." I thought to myself, "Cool, man. Marty was always good for that. Bless his soul, because as I said, he died last summer. He always would say, Kevin, you know I could drive this thing. Kevin, you know I could drive that. Kevin, you know there's no one better in a 935 than me." And he would just say that stuff, knowing that he's so full of shit, it's pathetic. But he was a good guy. Everybody loved Marty. And he was never in anybody's way. And he got on the podium a couple times. So by the time he gets to five, he can't get off the radio. "This thing is unbelievable. You get on passing everybody." I think we started like 11th or 12th, and he's running third. Coming out of five or going up to the bank, the motor pops.
Yeah.
It saws itself in two. Because it is making 1,000 horsepower. "Hey, man, I think the motor just blew up." And I said, "Well, Marty, you know what they say. They always run good before they blow." Oh, yeah. So he milks it way. He milks it back. They get him or whatever. Back in those days, if the car was off the track, you were safe. So we got nothing to do. We didn't make a lap. Well, the good news is Preston Hens' car didn't make a lap either. It actually made like four laps. He blew a turbocharger. And I was always set up to change turbos in the race, because that's what we did with 935s. I had a little toolbox that had everything you need to change a turbo. New gaskets, new bolts, new this, the turbo, new pipes, you name it. I toted this thing around because you could put it by the turbo and get it done without having to jump back and forth of the wall 9,000 times. Preston's car goes by with Bonnie in it, his daughter, and it's blown a turbo. And I watch that thing go by, and I go, "Oh, it's going to be a minute or two before it comes back around, but it's coming back in the pits, I guarantee it." It comes in the pits, and I'm waiting. And they park the car.
Hmm.
She gets out of the car. Preston's standing there. The crew chief, he didn't have any parts, because back in those days, Preston didn't have a lot of anything going on. And I thought to myself, I'm going to go fix his car. I got nothing else to do. I grabbed a whole turbo. I could see which turbo it was. I carried it down there with the turbo thing, and I said, "Who's in charge here?" "I am." I said, "You got a turbo?" He goes, "I don't have nothing." I said, "I'm going to change your turbo." I said, "Make sure you got a driver ready to go." He said, "Well, how long is that going to take?" I said, "Just a couple minutes." He goes, "Really?" So Andy and I change his turbo in a couple minutes, and they're ready. They're watching me do it. They are in awe, wondering who the hell I am. I am not on their team, and I just fixed their car. I said,
thing.
"Who's driving this thing? We
thing
need
that...
a driver in about a minute."
Wow.
And Preston says, "Bonnie, get back in." Bonnie gets in. We load our shit up. I says, "Can you take it from here?" Crew chief says, "Yeah."
This is
and
sounding
as I'm walking
a lot
away,
like...
you can hear someone say, "Who is that masked man?"
This is sounding a lot like the VW engine swap competition here.
Same deal. There you go. So Preston walks down later and he says, "Of course I know who you are because I know you work for Marty and Bill and Don, but maybe you'd like to come work for me. I probably could pay you more money." And I said, "Well, right now, no, because that didn't cost you a thing. We'll have to talk about that." I said, "Look, I came here to work. I had nothing to do. Bob, the crew chief, will just give me, you know, new gaskets and my bolts back. I'm happy. We need to talk." That's when I was introduced to then the third guy, except Randy Lanier. Okay. So now everyone's trading their 935s in for Marches. And there's no exception. Marty Hines gets a March. We do it for him one time, and then I'm back in 962s. I got to go back on the timing thing. 83, not 962s yet. I think I'm on the 908 long tail for Sutterfield.
Wow.
And we took the 935 out one more time, and then Marty got a crew chief for the march because I wasn't going to work on an American-powered car. I mean, I like the prototype fact of it, but, you know, just because I'm a Porsche guy, I didn't want to work on a Chevy. Not that there's a problem with the Chevy. I was a Whittington doing Indy cars in 80 and 81 with marches. So I was a candidate to know the March prototype, 81G, so I did. And then Randy Lanier bought one because he was driving with Marty in Marty's car.
Yep.
When Randy bought one, he needed a rig and all the crew to take him to Daytona. So he called me, and I wasn't taking anything at that point. And because this is now 82, and I think I took him, but I was doing a car for Preston, but it broke. Anyway, I don't know how I did it, but we, oh, I know what it was. We had our own rig, and we loaned him Collier's rig, which we had painted Yale blue, because Collier graduated from Yale, and it's a real cool color blue, so everything of Collier's became Yale blue.
Naturally. So, college colors on your racing stuff. Yeah, why not?
And, exactly. So I then added three different stripes down the side of it, because it just couldn't be Yale blue. Three different colors of blues and hue of different shades of medium and aqua. Right down the middle connected, you know, 6-inch stripes connected with little wings at the end, which I borrowed from the swap shop T-Bird cars that I was painting, too. And Randy calls and says, hey, man, you got a rig you could go to Daytona with? That's how he talked, you know. He always had this, hey, man. That's how
like
Randy.
You're running cheap and strong.
Yeah, he could talk any way he wanted with what he was into. So, I mean, what he was investing in, not with what he was doing.
Yes.
Physically. So, he comes to the shop with the car. And at that point, the dude that was the cop in Jaws.
Roy Scheider.
Got the new gig flying the L helicopter on the TV series Blue Thunder.
Yeah.
Well, it was a blue helicopter, or it was blue something. So because our rig, we had a conventional cab over, not a traditional rig, I nicknamed the rig Blue Thunder. And the truck driver came back from somewhere with it and had a special license plate made in a truck stop that said Blue Thunder.
Wow.
Randy saw that Blue Thunder license plate and the rig. Oh, man, I'm going to name my team Blue Thunder. And I said, really? He goes, I love this rig. And if my car's going to be in it, my team is going to be Blue Thunder. And I said, there you go. So now, if you remember, Blue Thunder was the series of the guys flying helicopters busting drug dealers.
Oh, goodness.
There's some irony in this one.
I was going to say, that's pretty sharp on his... Well, it's either really sharp or completely oblivious, but that's brilliant either way.
Oblivious, I'm sure.
Wow.
Anyway, like you said, Randy is someone who is most thankful that they've said we could start growing marijuana because it took the heat off his life sentence and now he's out. But anyway, so that was Marty. Now, when we were Whittingtons, rumor was that they were some sort of drug guys. These are all very smart guys. If they were ever drug guys, I never saw it. No one on my team, on our team, and I did not, I only was a Whittington crew chief, you know, the second or third year that I was helping those guys. Jim Bell was the guy that led it in the beginning with Jim Weber.
Yeah.
And then when they ran multiple cars, I came in and I would run one of the cars. Then we went to Indy, then I became the chief mechanic at the Speedway on Don's car. Bill had Rabbit Bartholomew, whatever his last name was. And then Keith Layton came into the program, who was an ex-Ron Dennis guy.
Yep.
Keith Layton worked with Ron Dennis in F1, and he came over with a great, great life of doing open wheel Formula One, and then we made him a tin top racer. So then he came in and joined the Whittingtons too. And we had many different guys through time with the Whittingtons, but you know, we would do an all nighter because we had to do all nighters every now and again. You'd think if they were moving drugs that of all these airplanes they had, because they had airplanes.
Oh yeah.
That you would see it, and people would always say, "Man, you must have seen it all." And we never saw anything. They wouldn't come in and say, "Hey, man, you want to get involved in a big drug deal with Escobar in Colombia?" No, this was not talked about. You know, all these guys did whatever they did because they could, I guess, or they were dumb enough to do it, and smart enough to keep doing it, or whatever. But you're right. You know, I think back of some of the guys that I worked for, and I would consider them all my friends. And a couple of them went to jail for, I don't think it had anything to do with drugs. It was, you know, tax problems or stuff. So, you know, I'm not going to say that any of them ever did anything like that. I don't know. I wasn't there. None of us were privy to it. They always paid us. And surely we wondered. But Preston, you know, he's a swap shop guy, you know. I can guarantee he never traded a bit of paraphernalia or anything ever in his lifetime. That's just not his makeup. Not that the swap shop has never been a cash cow or anything, but you know, he Preston did it the hard way. He's a self-made, very educated, smart guy, and he did it the hard way. He earned it. The other guys, I'm sure they earned it too, but in a different way. Stress, nerves, I don't know.
Well, and that era as well. I mean, being a Florida-based sports car crew chief and entrant and otherwise, at a time where, you know, I don't know if you've seen any of the Cocaine Cowboys documentaries or otherwise, but
seen them all.
At that time, whether it was through a check or cash, or otherwise, the offshore powerboat racing, sports car racing, IndyCar racing, the let's just say that the Colombian fueled economy in Florida
right.
Definitely made its way into motor racing.
It did. There's absolutely no question. And John Paul, I think, is the only guy that's really ever been, you know, caught and red-handed, and went away and did his time too, you know. And of course, I had John Paul drive for me. You bring up the 966. You know, he was destined to be in the car. It was rumored that John Paul had helped his father as a teenager because his dad asked him to. I think there was a lot of, I think today there was no way that John Paul could have ever been on any kind of a blame game because of, you know, what now we do, because if your parents were mean to children now, I don't blame the kids anymore for being, you know, this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
You know? And Junior's the same way. And, you know, if you want to go from the money that went into racing, I'm sure there are other forms of it that weren't in Fort Lauderdale, too. So, you know, not to say that we were the mecca of it. You know, I'm sure that there were other areas of racing that didn't come from Fort Lauderdale, too. I can't think of one, but just to be fair to everybody involved, there was other, you know, there were other fish frying, so to speak.
Yeah.
But John Paul's thing was, what a basket of talent he was, and without his father, you know, he would have had a great, a lot better career. And that's just the way the cards were dealt, for sure. But When we built the 966, based on the 962 was ready to be, you know, let out to pasture, so to speak, to the guys that were building new cars, this or that. I always had the idea of building an open cockpit car because it was always better that you could see the drivers in the car. Any of the coupes, of course, were always not the best in the world, because you didn't know who was ever in the car.
Sure.
If you were had a fan, you had to just know that he could be in the car. You were a fan of the car, not the person. And learning stuff from Preston always made me know that, you know, with A.J. Foyt in the car, Mario Andretti in the car, and Desiree Wilson in the car, and a lot of the other great people that we had in those cars, you know, it was the person in the car. It was, for me, the car was great for sure, and it had to be well prepared. But if you were liked by the guy driving the car, it was only because the car was prepared well. So they all went hand in hand. And when I bought, in those days when everybody was discarding all their old 962 stuff, I had customers or clients that wanted me to buy the stuff because vintage racing was, you know, going strong, and they were going to be vintage cars sooner or later. So I bought Jim Busby's fleet of cars. I was also one of Jim Busby's crew chiefs.
Yeah.
And think of the guys I got to work for being his crew chief. Oh, my God. And John Andretti is one of them. But the thing was losing its luster as we started coming into 89. And I bought all of Busby's stuff, which included a brand-new Chapman-built carbon fiber tub, honeycomb tub. And it's not all carbon fiber, it's honeycomb, and then it's got a carbon fiber top, honeycomb carbon fiber. So it's not only really torsionally stiff, but strong like bull and safe like, no 962,
sure.
Because of the honeycomb. So I got the idea. At that point, I had gathered up enough stuff from racing 962 since 1985 that I'd build a spider. And because I have this other talent with my hands of making stuff, I pinned out a car and actually named it a 966, the 1-6 coming a 9 because Porsche is 9, a 6 from a 62 and the other 6 from a 36. So I named the 966, and Jürgen Barth was actually at the shop, who was a motorsport director at Porsche at the time. And I said, "Do you think anyone at Porsche would have a problem if I called this thing a 966? And he looked at me and said, "Why would we have a problem with that?" We never had a 966, because
yeah.
They didn't. So I called it a 966, and that's why it's a 966. But then we, you know, I shaped it to kind of look 962 and 936-ish. Every part on the car is made new. Nothing came from a 962. I pinned and then formed every part. I made the plug. I made the bodies. I made the molds. Me and Andy. Everything was done here in-house.
Oh, crazy.
We redid stuff in the suspension, changing things around. And then I got B.F. Goodrich to help out because of my relationship with B.F. Goodrich, who was being bought by Michelin at the time. So we got to then be the test mule for the new Pilot tire. The Pilot tires were all tested on the 966.
Wow.
We had tires on our car that no one could see because they were Michelins, but they said other things on them. It was really cool to be a whole part of. John Paul did all the testing at three different test tracks in America privately to test the new Michelin tire. So that kind of helped us financially. And then we did the race at Daytona where we had Derek Bell, Justin Bell, and Jay Cochran.
And if I remember, that was might have been Justin's first big pro race, at least.
Yeah, yeah, and first time they ever drove together. So you can imagine how proud Derek was. I was already Derek's crew chief in the Busby's Miller car. So you know, and I knew him from racing 935s, but I was already his boss before with Busby, so he was a buddy, and I could just call him on the phone. So I said, "Hey, how would you two like to go to Daytona in the new open cockpit car?" He goes, "Yeah, we, you know, it was on Speed Channel or TBS had an auto, you would remember it, an automotive thing on the Sunday night or something." And what's his face did the story on it? The photographer, Rick Dole.
Yeah.
Rick Dole did the story on the car for, and did the video on it. And someone that he borrowed here in Palm Beach who did a lot of stuff, who the production shop was actually down the street. I forget the name of the company, but they did the big thing when we tested the 966, and we tested it with Bill Adam, tested the G93, the mid-engine 911. Bell and John Paul tested the 966 at Moroso. And we made the program because it was the new and exciting thing, an open cockpit car. And that's why I did it, back to learning from Preston. You get something that no one's seen before, even though the Spiders were out there before, but we were the first modern-day Spider. And everybody wanted it because you could see the guy in there, and it was a cool-looking car, blah, blah, blah. Except I was too busy working on the car and didn't have time to ever find any money to do it. Mm. So going to Daytona, we only ever had enough money to let each guy get in the car one time. And it was over. Everybody, B.F. Goodrich knew it because we were all B.F. Goodrich big time. Athene Karras was the managing PR boss for B.F. Goodrich, all of B.F. Goodrich at the time. And she thought it was a fantastic idea. She goes, I don't know how that's going to go over, that you've got our tires on the car and it's going to poop out in the fourth hour. And I said, well, you're just going to have to live with it. And I said, unless you guys want to give me money. She says, well, we're giving you tires. And I said, oh, yeah, okay. Great, thank you, and I appreciate it. But, you know, a little more money spent to run 24 hours. And I was trying to take it to Sebring. You know, it was more important for me to go to Sebring, but not, I mean, with Derek and Justin for sure. But anyway, we get to Daytona with a car, and everybody loves it. Oh, my God, it was back to the pit lane, back to the drag strip at, you know, back to Indianapolis and Le Mans the same year in 1982, changing the spark plugs at Indy in front of 250,000 people that you can see, the other 400 around the other side of the track. You want to talk about the memory stuff? Well, at Daytona, when we took that car, it was unbelievable. We stole the show. Yost won the race, and we were on the cover of USA Today, not the winner.
Why?
big moment for old Kev, because the car was cool. And if you remember, back to me learning from the old man, from Preston. For me, I needed the money. For him, he needed the cover for the money. I needed the money. So anything I could do. So I came up with this idea, because of having an American in the car and the Englishman, the Gulf War had just started. Yeah. I mean, 001 Gulf War in Iraq. So I came up with that Stars and Stripes on one side and the British Union Jack on the other. Painted it white, because Porsches are painted white. And we did that whole deal. And I had this idea that because it was only going to run out there for, you know, the stints of the drivers, that I would then get a scene to take it to the camel tent. And I came up with this little slogan called Signs of Support for Our Boys in Iraq.
I remember.
And I did that little thing in the front with the sticker that said, we love our troops. And then I put Army, Navy, Marines, and other stuff on the car in salute of our boys and girls. And I was, you know, a lot younger than myself, going over to, you know, get involved in this whole, you know, war scene. So she thought I was nuts. Athene said, you want to do what? I said, I'm going to call it Signs for Support, Signs of Support for Our Troops. She goes, sounds like a good idea. She says, let me get back to you. She called the local radio station, said, hey, we got this car we're going to do, and the guy that owns the car can't really afford to run it the whole race, because now she doesn't know what to tell her bosses that it's only going to run, you know, the first driver's stints. So she gets permission. She clears out this giant circus tent. I said, Athena, I think you might be surprised on how many people are going to come and sign this car.
Yeah.
She goes, you mean sign it? And I said, yes, signs of support. You need to get 40 black Sharpie pins, and they're going to sign it. Everybody gets to sign it. Jay Cochran, the American, is going to take it out the last hour of the race, because right now I know it can run the red. I know it can run that long. She goes, you're kidding, right? And I said, I'm not kidding. And we did it. And I said, furthermore, you could give the USO $1 for every signature. She goes, done. So we kind of calculated that we're almost 6,000 signatures on the car. There's probably 10,000. And they bellied up. Both her, Biff Goodrich, and I think IMSA ponied up a signature. And they gave the money to the USO. And there was stuff written on that car. You want to be patriotic. Oh, my God. I have the wing. I kept the wing. Because the wing was a long distance for the short courses, which is the only time it ever ran. We used a lot bigger wing. So I still have the wing, and there's one little picture on the end plate. A guy writes this little face, and it says, "Please come home, Ted Lowry," or Mike Lowry or something. Please come home. We love you. I can start to choke up right now. Anyway, you should see the signatures. Of course, all the drivers came. Everybody signed that damn car. I thought to myself, if I had $10 for every signature, I could have raced it for the year. But and because I never had the money, I'm a mechanic. You know, when Sharon and I came to Florida, we had $36 in our pocket. That was it. We didn't own a credit card. We had payments on one car. The other car she owned. So I don't come from money. So for me to do all this was just me finishing up another historic Porsche and getting paid for doing that, and then using the money to either support my two-kid family and or whatever. So then every time we took the car, when it went to Palm Beach Grand Prix with Derek and John Paul, car was fast there.
Yeah, it was.
But again, it had a problem. Crazy, because I had Mike Colucci and Kevin Doran on the team. These are big guys in our business.
Yep.
Kevin Doran came in. Kevin Doran's probably one of the most talented race mechanics I've known, period, end of story. And Michael's no slouch with Brumos all the years and whatnot. But I had the two of them. My mother had passed away a couple days before the Palm Beach event, so I had to leave. I came back for the race. The funeral was before and stuff. So I had, they're both friends of mine because we all worked together. Kevin Doran, of course, for the podcasters out there, was really the mainstay. Tom Siebel and Kevin Doran were Holbert's guys.
Yep.
And Mike Colucci was Brumos' guy. So I don't want to tell you, and the lead guys, where they came from and how I got them on my little two-bit team. But after that, every race, it was another color because I got someone to pay for the next race. We went to Miami for Norwegian Cruise Lines, and I invented that wavy paint job. Because remember, they were painted. We put stickers on the car Daytona because I had a local company, a sign company, who was just getting into making stickers, doing, you know, graphics on vinyl. And they made those one layer on a layer on a layer. They weren't printed. And then after that, every time the car was painted, it was Norwegian Cruise Lines for John Paul and the Colombian driver.
I'm forgetting his name as well, but I know the car.
Yeah. He raced there in the Chevy powered March once and did really good. I forget. And a good guy. And then it went to Miami as a Jägermeister car.
Mm.
We got funding from the distributorship who did Jägermeister. So it went there with John Paul and that Colombian kid. No, it was not the Colombian. It was the Puerto Rican. It was Victor Gonzalez.
There we go.
John Paul and Victor Gonzalez did that one. When it went back the next year with Pete Rose is a buddy of mine, and we went down with the Precinct, which was his restaurant in Ohio before he opened his new restaurant called Pete Rose's Baseball something in Boca Raton. But we did it for the Precinct. And we did it for John Paul and that other Colombian driver. We took it to Norwegian Cruise Lines at Road Atlanta. And I put little fish on it. And anybody that was somebody in my life at the time that was at the track could write their name in a fish and put the fish on the car anywhere they wanted. Now, you got to remember, models are being made of all the cars. Mini Champs And Mike Arnsdorf, MA Scale Models, were making models of every car we did. So all these people are, you know, are memorable, or what do they call it in clay? Memorialized.
Yes.
Because of all the models that are made of the cars, because every time I put a paint job on, I'm putting on like I want, trying to attract another person. And the only race that ever won, we put Brian Redmond in for Brian Redmond's very first, which it wasn't called Rennsport yet, at Lime Rock. It was pretty much an all Porsche event, and a lot of guys brought their 962s, and Brian rode it and won deal and won the race, and then the two guys that we ran the car at Zolder and Brands Hatch, Robin Donovan and this other guy who ended up going to jail for insurance fraud. What's his name? What a rat he was. Anyway, Redmond won there, and then it got a podium at Portland. I think it got one podium there. And John Paul got the best mover, the best something in the race. I got a trophy for it. I think it's the only trophy besides that unofficial race meeting with Redmond's thing at Lime Rock that it ever got, other than it always won best of show because everybody liked the car more than anything out there. Cool things with that car.
It had so many amazing liveries. That was one of the things that stood out. It was a fan favorite, but it had so many amazing liveries. And if I remember correctly, it also went over to Germany for the Inter Series, and there was some sort of, was there the legal battle with that insurance thing associated with that?
That was Brands Hatch and Zolder in Belgium. Yeah, because it won the biggest purse in the history of any car. It won $275,000 on insurance indemnity. And I won't, even if I remember his name, which I do now, I'm not going to mention his name because he doesn't deserve it. He's the guy that actually put the deal together for him and Robin Donovan. And Robin Donovan then the next year ran the K8 with Derek Bell at Le Mans.
Yeah.
So Robin was a pretty entrusted driver and a neat guy, and still is today. And I did make the 966 before Kramer made the K8s or K5s. I'm sorry, podcasters. That's my wife trying to meet me at the airport.
Oh, it's all
anyway,
good.
Yeah, they did an insurance indemnity program, but we had to finish based on a percentage of the cars that entered for the Inter Series. And there were two heats, and we had to finish 8th or better in the first one at Brands Hatch, and we finished 9th. He put $25,000 more into the insurance because it costs a lot of money to do it. He was just betting. It's just legal betting. So the first time he put in $60,000, he had to put $25,000 more in it because we didn't do it. And this is all based on Lloyd's in London, and they had people figure out how competitive the car would be against other. We ran against the K8 and this and that. And we actually had James Weaver tests the car at Brands Hatch, and he was quicker than the K8 in the test, but he wasn't driving the car in the race. And then we took it to Belgium, and we won. We finished third in the two heats. I think we finished third in one and sixth in the other, and the average was better than fifth in this one. And the dude won almost $300,000 in the deal. He was going to buy the car from me for $44,000. Can you believe it?
Wow.
$44,000. You win. I'll do it. You win. Pay me for expenses, and if you win, you buy the car $44,000. Deal. Only he won the money that never bought the car. Thank God he didn't. I mean, I sold it for more money than that when I sold it, but not that much more. But anyway, so yeah, that car then got. I don't know if any sports car has ever won that much in a race before. You tell me.
That's so pretty amazing.
So there's lots of stories on that car in between, but I probably should go, podcasters, at this point.
Yes, brother.
Thank you for listening to me.
Well, good Lord, I've got so many more questions to ask, so we will have to find time to do either a part two or just a continuation.
Whatever you want to do, boss, tell me.
This has been so much fun, Kev, seriously. This isn't you rambling or whatever. This is just great stories that I've been hoping to share with folks. So this has been an honor, man.
Yeah, I might tell them different the next time, but I always just say it's because I'm allowed to. They're my stories.
All right, and that is the finale, at least for this conversation with Kevin Jeanette. I genuinely hope you enjoyed it. There are some things I had forgotten about that we discussed, and just had me laughing and cackling as usual, because he's such a hoot. Such a genuine treasure, and there's so many more tales to be shared, so definitely wanting to get more of those to offer you here in the near future. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is a Marshall Pruitt podcast presented by Cooper Tires. Thank you for listening.